This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. When was the last time that you pulled out your phone, hopped on an electric scooter, and zipped off down the street? What about the last time you were walking down a sidewalk and almost got hit by one? It's been about 2 years since dockless electric scooters started appearing on city sidewalks all across America. And in those years, we've seen thousands of scooters pop up, new companies, new regulations, and new injuries. But one thing remains constant. People either love or they hate electric scooters.
I think the electric scooters are great.
They're the worst thing that have happened to the city of Charlotte in the last decade by far.
This is a great way to have a small carbon footprint and get pedestrians from point A to point B.
I consistently see stupid people on these scooters.
I don't always or ever wear a helmet, but I feel that I'm safe when I'm riding because I keep my wits about me.
I was at a red stoplight, four-way stop. A kid blew past me, ran the red light, and met head-on with a semi-truck.
And the scooter snapped in half, and it looked like he had broken his ankle.
People are all up in arms about head injuries and blah, blah, blah. Let's just enjoy life. Zipping around on the scooter brings me great joy.
Not worth it. So dangerous. Stay off of them.
Just some of the many, many messages that you left in our inbox about e-scooters across America. Today, we look at the debate between cities and the tech world over those electric scooters. Are they a fun, high-tech transportation solution for American cities, or are they just causing more problems? Joining me from NPR in New York is tech journalist Clive Thompson. His article about the fight over electric scooters is in the December issue of Smithsonian Magazine. You can find it at smithsonianmag.com. He's also contributing writer to Wired and New York Magazine. Clive, great to have you here.
Good to be here.
And we want to hear from you as well. You're already chiming in. We know you have thoughts about electric scooters. Have they shaped your city? Do you think they're good? Do you think they're bad? Are you a frequent rider like me? I'll admit that. Have you ever been run over by one? Comment on our Facebook page. You can tweet us at 1A. The email address, 1A@WAMU.org. Clive, I walk down the street here in Washington, D.C. Scooters on every corner. I have six or seven apps on my phone. I was in L.A. recently and in Santa Monica near the beach. It's a total takeover. Scooters everywhere. Paint a picture of the electric scooter revolution in cities across America.
Basically, what's happened is that in the last couple of years, a lot of these on-demand companies have arrived and set up anywhere from hundreds to thousands of scooters. And we're talking in towns, the very large ones you've mentioned, including some even much smaller places up and down the coast in the center of the country, pretty much everywhere. And it has it has an effect, a very dramatic and quick effect. I think all the people who called in, you've heard a little bit of that pro and con side, but people start making decisions within days because you got to understand it's literally a transformation of the way people move around that happens overnight. You wake up and suddenly there's 300 scooters on the street and people are zipping around, many people of which have never ridden one before. So it's a bit of a learning process for both the rider and the person who's, watching this stuff happen. So we are in the middle of a great transition, a transition point where people still aren't really sure how this is going to shake out.
And often when scooters come to town, you mentioned it's an overnight transformation. People start riding them for the first time. Drivers start seeing people on them for the first time, not to mention pedestrians.
Yep.
Often the transition time is not pretty.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think in every city that I spoke to, every mayor I spoke to, every rider I spoke to, even the people that like the scooters a lot will admit that there is like a kind of a steep learning curve, because think about it, you've got a lot of people who normally walk around, maybe they're sedentary, maybe they don't ride bikes, but now they can ride a scooter just because it's there for, 15 cents, 25 cents a minute, whatever it is. But they really have no experience in keeping themselves balanced. They don't know how fast that thing can go. Some of them go very, very rapid. They're not accustomed to what its tolerances are, what type of a bump can it take. So, you also see a lot of accidents. People are winding up in the in the ER with chipped teeth, with serious head injuries, all sorts of stuff. A study came out a little while ago that found that injuries for scooter-based stuff, you know, doubled basically between around 2014, 2018. So that's a snapshot of kind of the chaos in action.
A lot of head bumps, a lot of broken wrists. Now, Clive, your latest piece for Smithsonian Magazine compares the fight over these electric scooters to another time when new tech micromobility spread across America. That was the invention of the bicycle in the late 19th century. What happened when bicycles first came on the scene in America? What changed for people last time there was a revolution of this kind?
Well, what changed was that suddenly there was a way to get around rapidly that was not a horse. And that was really weird, right? So the first thing that happened is that actually the horses freaked out because they were not accustomed to seeing these weird contraptions rattling down the street towards them. So they would bolt or they would freak out. And what that meant is that all the livery drivers, the people that were, you know, driving something propelled by a horse, they got furious and they would jump off the livery and like get in fist fights with bike riders. They would literally fight them. They would push them into oncoming traffic. So you saw that happening. You also saw a lot of kind of interesting social revolutions, right? So women started riding bikes, and it gave them kind of a burst of mobility that they previously didn't have because, you know, the lives of women were very constrained and conscripted, ranging even from, you know, where they were allowed to go to the fact that they had to wear, you know, petticoats and corsets. So when they started riding bikes, suddenly they could go further away from their families. They could explore things. And it was a really, a lot of people saw it as sort of emblematic and catalytic of that first wave of feminism. In fact, Susan B. Anthony said, the bicycle has done more for women's liberation than just about anything else.
Hmm. Now, this was, by definition, a time before any bike lanes existed. So what was the press like? What was the culture like when bicycles descended on urban population centers? I'm going to guess that a lot of young people were like, woohoo, getting on bicycles and enjoying this new freedom. And a lot of other people, including people writing screeds in local newspapers, were all over them.
Yeah, exactly. It was very much like, who are these young hipsters riding these stupid things? There was this great comment by one columnist who said, the bicycle is the first vehicle that is not propelled by a jackass, but ridden by one. So like there was a lot of hilarious sniping and a lot of like kind of threat or menace. And city councils, you know, they actually started, they started like passing laws saying we can't have these things, right? So New York City, for example, banned them in all the parks. And much as sort of large companies, you know, the sort of scooter companies today kind of sometimes get in conflict with cities, you know, there was conflict back then. So after they were banned in Central Park, the CEO of the Columbia Bike Company, like the single biggest maker of bikes in the United States, he paid for a bunch of people to illegally ride bikes through Central Park so they would get arrested so that he could fund their defense in the courts, right? There was just stuff like that.
Form of corporate protest for micromobility. Yeah. Well, Clive, I mean, history has to be rhyming for you here. Look at, forget about Central Park. New York City has bicycles and bike lanes and bike sharing all up and down the city. But we're going to talk about this. They've banned scooters, no electric scooters there. This has to be history on repeat for you.
Yeah, totally. I mean, again, you have a new weird technology that's come along that is, you know, causing a new type of havoc and riot in the streets. And the, you know, the powers that be are you know, both, I think, justly and unjustly concerned. The one thing that's really interesting right now is that the scooter companies that are coming along, putting these scooters in the streets, they are, you know, they are coming in the wake of things like Uber and Airbnb, which was like the first kind of high tech wave of maybe 10 years ago that caught cities unawares. Like they didn't realize that Uber was going to completely transform the way people drove around their cities and really change the labor pool for driving, and they felt that they got kind of screwed by that. So a lot of city councilors and mayors this time are like looking at these scooters and going, okay, we are now forewarned and forearmed. So that's kind of the interesting new wrinkle.
So having looked at the 1880s, Clive, since you're an expert on that history, what's the one piece of advice you as the resident historian for this hour on scooters, that you might give to cities, to scooter companies, to people caught in between them about how to deal with this history on repeat, this next wave of micromobility hitting the streets?
Yeah, I think the first thing, the big thing that comes out is that any time that the physical environment of the city is not set up to allow for a new type of vehicle, you're in trouble. So you're going to have to think about, if you want that new vehicle there, you've got to change the shape of the city, right? Because when those bicycles came along, you know, there was really, there was a lot of foot traffic in the streets. There was a lot of foot traffic on the sidewalks. There was kind of no place for the bicycles to be. There was no bike lanes, right? You know, there was no sense of where this new vehicle should be related to everything else. And that's what caused the havoc. And so I think the lesson for today is, if you want these new vehicles and the benefits that they can bring, and the fans, you know, the people that want to ride them, you've got to figure out where they are going to be. You've got to carve out that space.
Dewey says, rode one while visiting L.A. last summer, hit a curb, launched myself over the handlebars, sprained my elbow, spent the whole week with my hand in my pocket like Napoleon. My best vacation story, 10 out of 10. Would injure myself again. Sandy wrote on our Facebook page, I just don't get why these cities just don't say no when these things are dropped off. Indianapolis charges something like $15,000 for them to register those things, and the companies pay it. And Amit wrote on our Facebook page, I like the idea. What I hate is that people are so inconsiderate when they leave them in the middle of the sidewalks. It's rude for people to leave them there. That's the issue for me. We're speaking with tech journalist Clive Thompson about the fight between cities and tech companies over electric scooters. Coming up, we're going to add two more voices, some experts to this conversation. Stick with us. It's e-scooters. I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. We ride, we ride. Welcome back to 1A. It's Todd Zwillick. We're talking about e-scooters on the streets of American cities and the fights between cities and tech companies with tech journalist Clive Thompson. Let's add two more voices to this conversation. Joining me here in the studio is Adam Kavakovich. He's the head of government relations for the Americas for the electric scooter company Lime. They're a big one. Adam, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Also in the studio, Gabe Klein. He's the co-founder of CityFi. They're a consulting firm that helps cities improve transportation and use new tech. He's also the former transportation commissioner for both Chicago and the District of Columbia. Gabe, good to have you here.
Thanks, Todd.
I should point out, in the spirit of full disclosure, Gabe and I are old friends, former roommates, just so people are aware, we know each other well, but you're invited because you're a true expert. And in fact, a lot of my education, aside from being a rider, on what e-scooters mean to American cities comes from you. So we wanted to have you in.
Well, thank you.
Good to have you here, man. We'd love to hear your thoughts as well about electric scooters. How have they shaped your city? If you're a frequent rider like me, what role do scooters play in your transportation routine? You can comment on our Facebook page. You can tweet us at 1A. Our email address is always 1A@WAMU.org. Gabe Klein, your reaction to what we just heard from Clive. Do you see similarities between the debate over bicycles in the 19th century descending on American cities and the contemporary fights over scooters on American streets?
Yes, absolutely. I thought Clive did a great job. And I mean, there's even more to it. We wouldn't have paved roads without the American wheelmen, which were the first cyclists in the 1880s who lobbied the feds and their local governments to pave streets. So there's a rich history there. But really, there's no truly new innovations, and there's no new reactions to those innovations, right? This is a story we've heard a million times. Anytime something new happens, people are nervous about it. Now, it's not that they're not justified at all. I mean, you're introducing scooters or bikes into a city that, or cities, sometimes suburbs, that were often designed around the automobile, depending on when they were built. Or they were refashioned around the automobile in the 1950s and 60s. But we see this with converting lanes for bus rapid transit, with building streetcars. There are a lot of people that are just sort of resistant to change.
Adam, America is a country built around the car. American consumers are drivers first. When scooters like Lime, your company, drop into an American city, these are small, vulnerable people on small, vulnerable scooters plopping into a predator world of cars.
Yeah, although I will say we don't ever drop our scooters into cities without permission. I think that's an important distinction to make.
Because, I was going
to
ask you about
that. Yeah, because, look, the technology companies typically build their product, take it to consumers, and then answer questions from government when that comes up. Scooter companies, we do something totally different. We can't get our product used by consumers without city permission first. So we work with more than 100 cities around the world to not only get permission, but also craft the right kind of scooter regulations. And I think one of the things we see is cities are really grappling with the infrastructure question, where scooters should be allowed, how many. But they also feel somewhat burned by companies who launched without permission in the past. And no one, including us, wants to see unlimited scooters on the streets.
So Lime doesn't do that, but your competitors, some people don't differentiate. Some scooter companies have done that, dump them on the streets and fight over it later.
We saw that in the early days. You don't see that as much anymore in the industry because I think cities, again, have gotten wise.
Clive, who was it who you said back in the 1880s, the bicycle manufacturer who mounted an action and got his people arrested in Central Park?
Yeah, Columbia, the Columbia Bicycle Company.
Columbia Bicycle Company.
The dominant one. They were selling, you know, millions of cycles a year.
Well, Adam, you're not dumping them on American streets. You've made that clear. But do you feel like the Columbia Bicycle Company of the late 19th century, do you feel like you're on sort of the cutting edge of micromobility with all of its pushback and all of its advantage and vitriol?
What I would say is that we see in every city we go to a fairly predictable pattern, which is that when scooters first are introduced, everybody's excited. The mayor rides a scooter on the first day, everybody's excited. And then people start abusing them. Most people are using them properly, but scooters get thrown into rivers, and some people start, having accidents. And then at that point, some cities do overreact and say, you know what, we just can't handle the scooters. What we hope to happen is that cities then have some patience, have some foresight to sort of properly regulate them, and then even get to the point where they say, you know what, these scooters are almost the missing piece in our city transportation puzzle.
Well, we've been asking you about your relationship with electric scooters where you live. Here's what one listener left in our inbox.
Hello, this is Ian from San Diego, California. I think many of the social and personal issues stem from the inadequate space given to anyone not traveling in a car. Cities across North America have been designed with giving the personal automobile the highest priority of infrastructure design on our streets, whereas sidewalks are frequently too narrow for more than two people at a time, and bike lanes, which should be used by scooters too, are poorly implemented in order to prevent disrupting motor vehicles. In order to reduce issues of electric scooters and other forms of transportation, politicians should reprioritize the design of our streets to minimize the utility of automobiles and maximize the mobility of people walking, riding public transportation, and of course, riding bikes or scooters.
And we got this from a listener. We need safe infrastructure for electric scooters, cyclists, and pedestrians to be able to travel together safely. That looks like taking space from cars so that everybody else doesn't have to fight for room and then blame each other when it's not there. And Gabe, a lot of this seems like an infrastructure issue, especially around safety. In places that already have good bike lanes, scooters seem like, in my experience, mm-hmm. a great fit. If it's all cars and all sidewalks, you're either battling cars on the right-hand side of the road next to the parked cars, or you're on the sidewalk where you might hit somebody and they really hate you.
Right, right. And we have this movement in the United States called Vision Zero, which we took from Sweden. They started that, I think, in 97. We brought it to Chicago in 2012. It's been adopted here in D.C. Everybody wants safer streets. We have a problem in the U.S., I would say a cultural problem and a physical problem. We've lost, we're losing 40,000 people a year to road deaths. That includes people in autos as well. We're losing 40,000 people a year to guns. So if we want to make change on our streets, and you could exchange scooter for bicycle in this conversation, we've got to reallocate space. There's just no other way to do it. Oslo just announced that they hit Vision Zero. They had zero fatalities on their roads last year.
But Gabe, bikes have been on the scene in America for over 100 years. If cities were going to wake up to say, maybe cars aren't quite the way for the city, maybe we should have more bike lanes so that we have safer cyclists, I feel like they would have woken up to that already in a lot of places.
Yeah. But here's the thing. And this is why the scooter companies pushing a bit is a good thing. Because the cities need the pressure and they actually like the pressure. It's not that the cities don't want to do it. It's that there's a bit of NIMBYism. There's complacency. There's resistance to change by the people in the cities. And often it's by older people, people that have been in the cities for a long time. And so actually cities in many ways are welcoming the scooter scourge because they want the pressure to help them to build the infrastructure that they need for everybody.
We've been wanting to do these bike lanes. People have been pushing back for ages, and maybe this will push people over to the edge to realize how necessary they were all along.
Exactly.
Adam, you said Lime does not dump scooters on cities.
Right.
Others have, and people know that. What's Lime's pitch to a city when it wants to move in? What's your promise to planners and city officials about what you can do for them?
Yeah. Well, we think what we find works best is really speak to their existing priorities. So, for example, a lot of cities care about sustainability. They've set their own sustainability goals for reducing emissions. And about a third of scooter trips replace a car trip. So we've prevented about 25 million car trips globally. Congestion. A lot of cities want to reduce congestion. Scooters are helpful with that. The first mile, last mile problem. Getting from your home to transit and then from transit to your job, and transit deserts for people who live more than 15-minute walk away from a transit stop. All of those goals are things that cities really do care about. And so I think they do see in scooters a solution to many of those problems.
I'm sorry that you have to answer for your entire industry because you said you don't dump them on the street. But the tech industry does have this reputation, and they love it, move fast and break things. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of people in your industry have adhered to that. Here's another cliche, ask for forgiveness, not permission. Then they invade. City officials left figuring out what to do when angry residents knock on their doors and say, I got run over by a scooter today, city official. What are you doing about it? But this has been a factor in your industry. Is it changing? Does some companies still operate that way?
Not really anymore. That was really the version 1.0 of the scooter industry when you saw that in basically 2018. And again, cities have really gotten wise to it. So I think what you see now is cities talking to each other about the best way to regulate this. And there's a lot of experimentation. I think one of the fun things about working with cities is they are trying to protect certain values, but they do want, in most cases, scooters to succeed. And so you see a lot of experimentation from cities about how to properly regulate, how many to allow, what to do with parking and riding rules, what to do with speed limits, and we welcome that experimentation.
You talk about speed limits. This is high tech. You can do them automatically. My scooter here in D.C., I swear to you, I loved it when it was 15 miles an hour
yes.
and I could zip around town. It's now mm-hmm. 10 miles an hour. I have a hard time going faster. That's the District of Columbia told you guys to put a governor on there and be safe.
And I think what people don't totally understand is that a slower scooter is not necessarily a safer scooter. In some cases, if you're on the road, if you're in a bike lane, it's actually less safe for you to be slower. So we think 15 miles an hour is probably the better speed limit. 10 is probably too low.
I'm with you there. I don't usually take sides, but I wish I could go faster. I just got to be honest.
Yep.
I wish I could. I don't know whether or not I'm in more danger if I go 15. I get it. I get 10. I wish I could go faster. That's just the way it is. But we are going to talk more about what it really means when companies like yours make deals with cities. And there's a lot of money and data at stake. But let's stick on safety for just a moment, because for so many people, this is the big issue. We heard from a lot of you in our inbox. Here's what one of you told us.
Hi, my name is Karen. I'm from San Diego. I'm an emergency physician at the University of California in San Diego. And the number of traumas we are seeing from scooters is unreal. People are hitting their head, having head injuries, knocking teeth out, multiple fractures, wrist fractures, knee fractures. It's really unbelievable because we have a lot of scooters here. And that's what happens when you take an adult and put them on the equivalent of a skateboard with a motor on it that they haven't been on since childhood, and then add a little alcohol in there. But people don't realize when they step on these things the amount of trauma and injuries that occur, to the point where it's becoming a huge problem, not only here in San Diego, but around the nation.
If this is the straight dope from an ER physician in San Diego, mm-hmm. she is seeing the injuries. It's no lie. She's seeing a huge upswing.
Right. Well, here's the thing. I'm going to be honest. Just like we're saying that these companies often launched into cities without permission, they also launched consumer-grade equipment. These were scooters that you could buy on Amazon for $499 with little 6-inch, 8-inch plastic wheels. The equipment's coming a long way. They're getting, real rubber tires, sometimes air in them, shocks on the front, bigger 8 or 10 inch wheels. So I think that the equipment's getting better. It's more industrial grade. Having said that, there's a risk to everything that we do. Crossing the street, you know, I worry for my kids often in DC crossing the street. There is a risk. However, we're losing 40,000 people a year in automobile crashes or crashes with automobiles. We don't have that experience with scooters. And then the other reaction is, well, everybody needs to wear a helmet. But you know what? What the data shows is that when you force everybody to wear helmets, they stop riding bikes. And I imagine it would be the same with scooters. And the benefits to people's health, to the environment, are overwhelming by getting them on these smaller devices.
Adam, I know you don't want any restrictions to get people to get on, click, spend money on a Lime scooter. Helmet laws might be a restriction. Most people in D.C., where I live, ride these scooters with no helmet at all. You think that's a good idea?
Well, we encourage people to wear helmets. I certainly wear a helmet whenever I ride a scooter. But I think part of it is the choice to ride a scooter today is mostly a serendipitous choice. You're not planning on riding a scooter. And so you might be walking along and you see a scooter and you use it. And if that's the case, as it is most cases today, you don't have a helmet with you. One of the solutions to this, by the way, is more scooters. Because if you have more scooters around, they can become a plannable part of your transportation mix. And we think we'll see greater helmet adoption by people bringing helmets with them.
Daphne emailed, "Scooters, Gabe, are not as environmentally sound as some people think. They're cheaply built. They don't last long. They wind up in landfill. Also, trucks are driving around at night to pick them up, to reposition them at other locations or charge them where they'll be needed in the morning. This is not an environmental panacea."
Look, it's not a panacea, and if scooters, as you know, at one point they were lasting about 28 days on the streets before they were getting lost or stolen or vandalized or whatever, in that case, I think the caller is correct. Having said that, as they add better technology in terms of GPS tracking, alarms, lock to devices so that they can actually, in some cities, you actually have to lock them to poles, then you see them disappearing less. Also, you see some companies using like Coaster Cycles, electric cargo bikes to actually pick them up. And so, again, with the evolution and the maturing of the marketplace, I think it'll get better. But she has a valid point.
Yeah. Now, we're going to talk after a break about what happens when scooter companies come to cities, what those deals look like, what it means for consumers and for their data, critically. But before we do, Gabe, scooters aren't legal in New York City. We mentioned that. In some places, it's a boom. L.A., D.C., you name it, scooters everywhere. New York, nada. They outlawed them. Last year, Nashville's mayor tried to ban them altogether, was only stopped by the city council there. D.C. recently cut the number of scooter operators in half, eliminating Lime and several others, as I understand it. What tends to dictate when a city says yes or when it says no to scooters?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, New York, I'm friends with the folks that run the transportation department there. I know them well. I mean, I think their view is New York is the only mega city in the United States. It's just a little bit different. They have put a lot of bike infrastructure in over the years, but in a place like Manhattan, where it's extremely fast and dense on like 8th Avenue, they just don't think that it's a good idea. I'm not saying I agree with them. They also don't have, or they just, I think, recently legalized electric bikes, which were illegal for a long time. Now, in terms of like D.C., they cut it in half because they did a pilot process. And this is what a lot of cities do. They say, hey, come one, come all, you know, show us what you can bring, the quality of your devices, how you operate. And then they say, OK, now that we've gotten a year under our belts and we've seen what 12 or 8 or 10 companies can do, we need it at a reasonable number that we can manage. And so it's very normal to then scale it back. From a pilot program.
Citywide beta test.
Citywide beta test. And then you say, okay, we're going to do a concession arrangement with 4 companies.
Adam, what happened with Lime in D.C.?
Well, we competed. And actually, the city in their own scoring said that we had been the best performing operator historically among the operators. But the way that they weighed their scoring, they weighed a little bit more towards sort of promises for the future. We're actually appealing their decision, and we continue to operate because the city has let us continue to operate through the end of March, but we hope to successfully appeal that decision. But I do think that it does point to there will be consolidation. There will be more cities choosing a limited number of operators. That's probably the right policy. And sometimes we hope to be among the winners, and sometimes we may not be.
And we should say some of these companies are true young startups. Some of them are owned by the big boys. If you've been on a jump scooter, that is owned by Uber, right? Some of the big companies that we're used to are running, have bought up, gobbled up, and running these scooter companies now. BVP tweeted this, please talk about how these scooters are not really made for smaller people. I'm 5 feet tall, and most of the scooters are made for taller folks. This makes it very awkward to ride. I like them, by the way, and I'm over 50. We're going to talk a lot more about e-scooters on the streets of America and also what happens when it's time to make a deal between one of these companies in a city. Clive Thompson, tech journalist, is here. Lime's Adam Kavakovich is here. And Gabe Klein of CityFi as well. More from our guests, more from you on that electric scooter going down the street on Todd's Willick. This is 1A. Back to our conversation now about electric scooters with tech journalist Clive Thompson, Lime's Adam Kavakovich, and Gabe Klein of CityFi. Clive, thanks for waiting patiently while these two policy experts go at it here. You've interviewed a lot of people about e-scooters for your piece in Smithsonian Magazine. What were some of the common threads? What surprised you, what you heard from people across country?
Sure. One of the things that was interesting and surprising was that some of the fans of electric scooters were folks who had mobility issues, right? They might be older, and so they don't walk as fast and they don't walk as far. And they would tell me that when they had these scooters available, they would actually go longer distances, which they really enjoyed and appreciated. Yet at the exact same time, there was also complaints from people with mobility issues because they might be using canes or their own, you know, seated electric vehicles or walkers, and they would run into these scooters sort of, you know, badly parked in uncomfortable ways across the sidewalk. So it was sort of a really an interesting glimpse at how complex this issue is, because you could have the exact same sort of demographic cohort having two diametrically opposed views of what these scooters were good for.
Now, you've also covered, in some cases, the backlash, because in some cases, locals have become anti-scooter vigilantes, vandalizing these scooters in protest. There's an Instagram feed called Bird Graveyard that illustrates the phenomenon. So talk a little bit more about the extreme end of the scooter hate spectrum here.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that was not hard to see. I actually, when I started my research, I tweeted. I said, so do people love these things or hate them? Are they neutral? And what I discovered was that It was completely divided. There was absolutely no one in the middle. Total hate, total love. But the hate, you know, maybe this is just Twitter being Twitter. It went on for a very long time. I mean, this thread probably was alive for like a few weeks, longer than almost anything I've encountered in my 12 years on Twitter. So part of it is that people are, you know, I think the really justified anger is when someone's whipping down like a sidewalk and going really fast. And you see, I've seen that in New York City where I live. They're not, you know, these are personally owned scooters. So people are just, you know, blind with rage at that because they feel vulnerable. You know, they're a person, they're walking down the street and suddenly there's this Yahoo going, you know, really fast. And that can actually be, you know, legit dangerous. There are people that have died when being struck by someone going fast on a scooter because they were pushed into traffic or whatnot. Well, so there was a lot of just venomous anger. There's also kind of what you could kind of call people who are self-aware about some of the fact that they have divided loyalties. One guy said, here's my verdict on loving and hating scooters. When I'm on them, I love them. When someone else is riding them, I hate them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The ultimate transportation narcissism. We all suffer from it to a certain degree. Let's define our terms really, really quickly because we keep throwing around some names. Scooter companies, boy, they just multiply. I'll name a few. You got Skip. You got Jump, which is owned by Uber. Lyft has their own scooter brand that they put on the streets. You've got Bird. You got Bolt. You got Razor. And Adam, you've got Lime.
And Spin.
Oh, Spin too. So take your single syllable catchy word. There's a scooter company to match it. Now, Adam, it's clear, as Clive says, it's extreme love or extreme hate, especially on social media, sometimes through vandalism, unfortunately. Did you anticipate this? I mean, if you'd read Clive's piece about 130 years ago, you might have expected some of the extreme reactions. Did any of this surprise you?
Yeah, one of my favorites was last summer, Washingtonian Magazine in D.C., where I live, ranked scooters their best public nuisance. But they said it was the best, right? So they acknowledge that this
gotta
is this thing.
Yeah.
So I think you see very, you know, torn feelings about this. But I think, you know, Clive of sort of spoke to this, that I think history is on the side of scooters, frankly. And what we're experiencing now is the normal evolution that anything new, not just new forms of transportation, but new forms of anything, go through, where you go through the peak of high expectations, the sort of the chapter of disillusionment, and then you sort of finally come to terms with it. And I think that's where we are now. But I do think that city policy is trying to adapt, and we do work really closely with cities across the board. But one of the things that's interesting, so Arlington, Virginia, where I actually live, published their statistics on citizen complaints about scooters. The very first month that scooters were on the street was the high watermark of complaints, and then they dropped. And I believe that is probably true for most cities. So one of the things we say to city officials is just be patient, because the verbal, you know, complaints you get from non-riders in that first month, this is as intense as it's going to get.
It's the newness, right?
Yes,
when you're a city
absolutely.
Official, it's newness that people hate.
Well, even when people say, you know, the scooters are everywhere, I assume that's because they're a new feature of the streetscape.
Right.
I think people probably said the same thing about electric street lamps when they were first introduced. They're everywhere.
All right. I want to talk about cities, and I want to talk business. We got this email from Angela, who says, I work for the city council in Indianapolis, which you referenced a short while back. One of the principal reasons that our city government charges scooter companies a per scooter registration fee is to fund improvements to bike lanes and other multimodal infrastructure so that scooters can safely be operated. I supported scooters when they first came to town, but the refusal by the scooter companies to ensure that their riders would use them appropriately has made me and others hate their product. And that's from a city official, Gabe, in Indianapolis.
Yeah. Well, look, this is a tough one. There's a bigger sort of macro issue going on the funding side, by the way, where people need to understand that transportation companies, for the most part, don't make money. And this is a little bit of a controversial thing to say, because you have, you know, Uber's worth $27 billion or whatever they're worth. But the reality is, very few companies outside of what we call the OEMs, the car companies, actually make money. Lime's not profitable, right? Most of these companies are not. So cities need to understand, like Car2Go just left the U.S. BMW ReachNow just left the U.S. So you have to be careful charging. You have to charge enough to cover your administrative costs. But if you charge too much, these companies may go away.
Yeah. Now, Gabe, one of the things that you've done is you've been on both sides of the table when these deals get struck. You used to be a city official. Now you're a consultant. And you sort of help with these deals a lot of times. When Lime or another scooter company wants to do business with the city, Indianapolis, D.C., you name it, what does the deal typically look like? Because this is not public transportation in the way that we're used to it. This is a private company that wants access to the city streets to make money. Do they offer to give the city a share of the fees? What happens?
They can, although that's not as common. I think we'll get there. I think with these concession arrangements, we probably will get there. But right now, it's about equity. It's about, can you serve the entire city, or at least the majority of the city where people live? So not just lily white neighborhoods, but serve everybody that needs them, old and young, black and white, Latino, and so on and so forth.
Most cities insist on that?
Most cities that I've worked with do. Most of the larger ones do. I mean, you have cities like Dallas that just made it a complete free-for-all, but I don't think that model really worked, right? They generally want some administrative fees to cover their cost of having to administrate this program. Right. And beyond that, there's typically a permit and there's some data collection. The data collection, by the way, is for the benefit of the public and the agency, but also for the scooter company. And this has been really contentious.
Yeah, it sure has. And you teed me up perfectly. Maybe it's because I know you, because Lime, any other scooter company, Adam, they work with an app on your phone. And that means that just like with Uber or with Lyft or any other app, the company knows when I get on, the company knows when I get off, and where I go every time. And that data is about me and my travel habits every single time. Adam, who owns that data? Who does it belong to?
We really take steps to make sure that it is kept private. There is most cities require us to share aggregated trip data, and we think that's a useful thing. There's a standard called the Mobility Data Standard that the city of Los Angeles has pioneered. That allows cities to be able to say, oh, look, there's a lot of scooter usage in that area. Maybe we should build a bike lane there, right? Maybe there's a lot of traffic there, a lot of demand. That's helpful. But we need to balance that with rider privacy, because, you know, we don't want to we assure our riders that we are not sharing with them their personalized trip data.
Right. My personalized trip data, they know where I go, when I go. It's the same with Uber or Lyft, as I mentioned. Gabe, I would imagine, look, anytime the phone and personal data is involved, it's the same with Google and the big boys. The really valuable thing is you.
Right.
It's your habits. I'll bet you there's a retailer down the street from me that would love to get an alert every time I drop a scooter off in their neighborhood, because then they can tell me what's on sale.
Right. They can sell you something right there on the spot on your phone. So this is a sort of a false premise out there. I'm going to diverge, I think, with Adam a bit on this, because this idea that, you know, cities, not national government with the Patriot Act, but that cities need some level of aggregated data or individual trip data in some cases, but shared in aggregated form if it's made public. They need that not just for planning purposes, but they need it for safe operations purposes, because we're moving from a time where we manage our transportation system with analog signs and signals, and we're moving into managing it in the digital age. So you have companies like Waze that are sort of preempting government by directing people on the streets, right? And so it's very important for cities like LA or DC to have this mobility data specification. And we actually helped to spin up the Open Mobility Foundation. People can check it out, which oversees MDS and other data specs, so that cities and citizens are controlling that data. And it doesn't just belong to the private sector, who then can monetize it to third parties like Foursquare.
So how reluctant have scooter companies been to part with this data and share it with the cities that are hosting them for the benefit of the people who ride them?
It depends. Lime's actually been very good. Lime, Spin, Bird have all been supportive of MDS. Uber and Jump, less so. I think Lyft, less so. And this is often because they have other businesses to worry about, right? They have a ride-hail business that's very large, and they're concerned about sharing data on that business. I think the scooter companies, for the most part, because they're operating an actual fleet of company-owned vehicles versus peer-to-peer, just people's cars, understand that to scale in an urban environment, they're going to have to share a certain amount of data with the city.
Adam, your company, Gabe says, is one of the better ones, so I put you in the impossible position of answering for your competitors. Maybe that's unfair.
Sure.
But your industry overall, look, a lot of companies are less willing, maybe, than Lime to share this data back with cities who need it for those very things that you're talking about, knowing who's traveling where, being able to decide where infrastructure should go or how their citizens are moving in the mornings and the evenings.
It's really not an issue for us. And I guess I think that because...
But for your industry, it is.
I'm not even sure I would say it's an issue for the industry. I think the majority of players recognize that sharing protected, aggregated trip data with cities is good policy. And I think that's because we recognize that, again, this form of transportation is not going to be successful without both safe hardware, safe riding norms, but also safe infrastructure. And cities are our partners in that. We our product cannot be ridden 100% safely without having safe streets. And cities are responsible for that. So they have a role to play.
What about the personal privacy aspect of this? Like we just mentioned, I want to drill down on this.
Mm-hmm.
My personal data, where I travel and when, has to be extremely valuable to anyone who wants to sell me anything on my phone. I drop off a scooter, a business is across the street, they want to ping me with a coupon right away. I frankly don't want them knowing where I just traveled and when, but right. I can also see a great big revenue stream for Lime or somebody else to sell them that piece of information about me.
I think you're jumping a couple of steps ahead in the evolution of this industry. Nobody's doing that today, and
they will if they can, though.
But we're really focused first on the basic problem: how do you get scooters available, right? So, for example, the city of Chicago ran a scooter pilot last summer, and we were able to use data from when people opened our app but didn't take a ride, and where they were, to show the city here's where more scooters were needed. Here's where there's demand for more scooters. That's not personalized. That's just purely aggregated data. So I think we're really just crawling at this point in terms of this question of data.
Gabe, you mentioned briefly the issue of getting scooters to underserved areas, to every neighborhood, not just lily white neighborhoods. Many cities insist on it, but when the scooter tires meet the road, how effective has that been? It's a big issue in cities like Washington, D.C. Have scooters done anything to truly democratize micromobility to neighborhoods?
Well, so this is really interesting. You know, I was at Zipcar as an executive, 14 years ago, when working with D.C. government, they required that we put vehicles into Southeast D.C., and we thought it was going to we thought they weren't going to do any business. And you know what? They were super busy. Everybody needs transportation. So sometimes what happens is that the scooter companies, for instance, have to put scooters where they wouldn't intuitively put them. Their business analytics teams are like, no. But they learn that actually people do need them. In other cases, they are not used as much. And what often needs to happen, in my opinion, is that you need to have a trade-off. So you say, you know what, we're going to have lower fees for the companies because we understand we're asking them to do things that in some cases we don't even do ourselves with our own transportation system. And we don't want scooters to be the scapegoat. We want them to help. And so in that case, it's important, I think, for the city to understand the business model and how they can support it, not hurt it.
Pardon me, Adam.
Couldn't agree more with Gabe. And City of Portland does something very interesting where if you can get a certain number of rides in low-income areas, they'll actually grant the operator a bigger increases in their scooter fleet. So they're incentivizing operators to work with low-income communities to get more rides. That's a great model, and too few cities are doing that.
Clive, last word, just a couple of seconds. But based on what you know about the history of bicycles, what's next for America and the scooters raining down on us?
Well, you know, I think actually it's an interesting cautionary tale because bicycles came along and they were successful, you know, partly because they were owned by individual people, a little different from scooters today. So they had kind of a moral force in arguing for things like, hey, we need roads to be paved. And they successfully argued for that. And that paved the roads of the country, which was great for the cyclists, but unfortunately also great for the next tech that came along, which is a car. And the car ended up sort of supplanting the bicycle, right? You know, to our lasting regret. The reason why we're having these fights over scooters and bicycles and everything in the streets of cities is that the cars took those paved roads and dominated. So this is sort of this history lesson, I think, would perhaps want to make everyone observing these scooter companies and scooter stuff being a little cautious about how things roll out over the next little while.
Go back and
read. The result could be kind of weird.
Go back and read Clive Thompson. You'll get a sense of where scooters might be going in America. Clive Thompson in this month's Smithsonian Magazine. Clive, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Adam Kavakovich, head of Lime's Government Relations for the Americas. Adam, thank you.
Thanks.
Gabe Klein, co-founder of CityFi. Thanks, Gabe.
Thank you, Todd.
And remember, you will find the 1A podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review. It helps people find us. This conversation was produced by Catherine Frink and Emmanuel Johnson in partnership with Smithsonian Magazine. Thanks for joining us. It's 1A from WAMU. I'm Todd Zwillick. I wanna scoot so fast in my head. Step back together.